Michael Labash and Tony Leondis, directors and writers of the film.
How are y'all doing?
Hi, good morning.
Oh, we sit here. We've never done this before. This is our first.
Okay, we'll keep
so you guys have
You're Michael?
I'm Tony.
Then
that's
I sit
Tony.
And
right.
I'm Tony.
Okay, I got him right now.
Okay.
Tony, I have to find out what on earth happened to you. How did you go so wrong? You were headed
to be a priest.
To be a priest, and then
I know,
happened?
Right? My dad's a priest.
I know.
And my little brother's a priest. Yeah, you get married in my religion. Obviously, it's the most scandalous thing. Greek Orthodox.
Oh.
Yeah, Greek Orthodox. You know, I was going to be more of like a family counselor. I was always interested in counseling and like family therapy and working with kids and stuff. So I was going to do that. And then, I don't know, I went to those Disney movies that they were putting out, and I just loved what the stories they were telling, and I realized that I wanted to do a different kind of, it sounds so stupid, like a different kind of ministry, a different kind of like, I liked working for Disney because I feel like they do really, they tell nice stories that the world should have, and I know it sounds corny, but it's kind of the truth.
No,
I never want to tell anyone, I try not to tell people that because it sounds so corny, but I just feel like it, like they really tell stories that are really needed in society today, and so I just made the that transition and decided to leave the counseling stuff behind.
But it's a huge leap.
It is.
I mean, you came to LA and you studied it.
I studied classical art, like just figure drawing and all that stuff in Boston for a while, and then I went to CalArts, which is that film school in California that all the animators kind of go to. And then I just took off from there. Yeah. It's
so
a crazy journey.
Are you glad?
Oh, I'm so glad. It's what I'm meant to be doing. It's absolutely what I'm meant to be doing. Absolutely. Yeah. I love my life and it's wonderful and I feel really lucky and blessed and all that stuff. So yes.
So what was the hardest part about doing this movie?
Hardest part.
Following up a great, don't you think?
Yes, I was trying to think if there was something maybe. Yeah, I guess in general, I was going to say it's related to that. What the specific would be, I think it's trying to do something that's going to live up to the standard of the first one, and what the audience expectations are. And you know, we love the film, so you know, it's just the pressure of just being a fan of it yourself and wanting to live up to it, and yet not wanting to repeat yourself, even when you don't mean to. You find that's always the challenge, like with making a sequel, is some of it has to be familiar and you have to strike that right balance. You don't want to go into completely foreign territory, but you don't want to, and it's just unbelievably difficult to navigate the right balance. So I think we achieved it, hopefully we did, but I would say that was the overall
day-to-day
the hardest.
Yeah, we wanted to use the same characters so we didn't end up repeating. A lot of sequels end up like you add a child or a sister or something, and then they go through a little journey. But we thought that there was still more to tell in this story of this family that comes together, kind of what happens after the happy family is together. So we thought that there was enough just with these characters, so we didn't have to repeat the same journeys.
What's the difference between doing something that's theatrical and something that goes direct to video?
None.
Really?
We get less time and less money.
Well, except for that. In our heads, right. He's right. But in our heads, none. We try to approach it. Tony and I, Chris Chaser, the producer, and our art director,
our editor,
we're all from feature. So luckily we had a team that, we all understood what the kind of, process and the sort of level that you need to bring the work to, but also realizing, with, like Tony said, the budget constraints, you also have time restraints. But still, I think if it's done smart, that's still only relative. If I say so, I think we all had a real good feel for the first film and the characters and all that. It's just quicker, It's just quicker, and maybe in some respects that's better because you don't have a lot of time to second guess, which sometimes you have more, that can go the wrong way too if you have more time and more money. But there definitely were days where it was like, we wish we'd had more time and more money. But
is there less pressure?
Oh, God, no. Sure.
Really?
It's all the pressure I guess it all depends on the filmmakers. You want to do your best work and you want to make a movie that you're going to be proud of and that lives up to, hopefully, the original. So
Yeah, because
there's a lot of pressure doing Lilo because they're so beloved. I mean, these are like the most beloved characters, I think, in the last 20 years in Disney history. Everyone loves Lilo and Stitch. So maybe Mulan a little, but I think these especially.
Well, they definitely, Stitch is definitely, I think, or at least like since Lion King, I mean, Stitch is a character that almost now seems to live, it's almost like Mickey Mouse. He lives outside the film in a lot of ways, you know.
Just trying to come up with something that is as good as the first one, or we can really honor these characters and have the same voice, was a lot of pressure for us to try to equal that. So,
what's your process for working together? Do you guys kind of split tasks up, or is it more of a collaborative effort all the time?
I think we do a little both.
Both. That's what I was going to say. Both.
We structure the stories together. We beat out the stories, all the sequences, and we do a lot of that. I did more of the dialogue. We're working with the actors, and Michael took on a little more of the actual hands-on drawing, storyboarding, things like that. We both do a lot of writing. I write on the computer, like on pages, and he writes.
I tend to draw the boards, you know, the storyboards out. But it was, I think it's the kind of process when you're making an animated film that way, it works. There's a point in the beginning where you benefit from having a back and forth, and then as the process goes on, certain things like the art direction or like the voice directing, you don't need two people to do that. It's sort of an interesting tradition because at Disney, you know, what used to be a two director team was really more of like an administrative aspect to the directing and one that was the creative aspect, and then that sort of evolved into something where it was both creative, or somebody tended to be more like the animation director and somebody else was maybe more the story director. And now even that seems to be de-evolving into a solo director. But, you know...
The good thing on this project is because we had less time.
Right.
We needed, like, all of our... Every skill we had, because we're both storyboard artists, and as storyboard artists, you have to write as well. So we both... Thank God there were two of us, because we had so little time to put this together, the film wouldn't feel as full and as close to the feature as if there weren't two of us on this project.
Because the actual making of the film... a very real way, you know, with animation is it's that period not between when things actually been pinned up as a storyboard and when it's begun animated. There's that period where you cut it into a story reel, you know, with the editor, and that's where you're really making the movie. And as we were there, you know, we just felt like, wow, this is such a fluid process because our editor was really good and could respond and have ideas of his own. But Tony and I could sit there and rewrite and reboard literally in the room. It wasn't like we had to, like in some cases where if the directors aren't the writers or even board artists where you have to. And that's where time and money can really get dicey where, you know, you'd say, oh, gosh, you know, this isn't working. Okay, call the writer in. Oh, you know, and then you got to wait to have the writer come in with his solution. The time that takes time, but we were able to make those sort of hair. You know, we could adjust for changes almost immediately, really, and that was a real fun part. I mean, it was really challenging, but I think we avoided a lot of wasted energy or effort that way. So I forgot what we were for.
You were saying, I want to understand this so I can.
Yeah.
Related to my readers who don't really understand how this works. You were talking about the story reel, cut into the story reel.
Right.
Okay, so now once you have are rough sketches and kind of follows the story, and so you put it into like a projector, and then you show it, and as it's going along, you say, oh, we don't like this section,
right.
We should maybe...
It's almost like, imagine these are all little draw. Like, we just do all the main beats... it's almost like a comic book. You make a comic book on big storyboards, and you just line them up. And there's hundreds. There's like maybe I think 160 drawings for each sequence, just on the storyboard. And then so you take those storyboards and you input them all in the computer, and then you time it in the computer so it'll look just like it looks animated. So in animation, instead of doing like to pick up the glass, in the storyboard you do this to go get the glass, and then you go have them pick up the glass.
It summarizes the action.
I see.
You time it as if it's animated in the correct time, and you work with that story reel and finesse it all the way until it's animated. And then you have your story reel, let's say, and it's timed, and you put music. We put 10 tracks, and we cast the actors, do their voices. And then you slowly, when animation comes in, you substitute. So you say, oh, that scene came in. So in all the story reel, you maybe have this much animation, then this much, then this much, and you animate it different.
And
so
actually,
by the time it's all done, it's all animated.
And actually, animation, what they refer to as a scene in live action terms, is a shot, a single shot. So you may, you know, one character literally just opens a door. That's a scene, and
anytime you move the camera to new places.
But it's just what's actually happening, and that's the interesting thing about animation, is that that's, you're actually making the movie before you've shot it. You've edited it before it's shot, before the acting or the animation begins. Whereas in live action, they shoot all the footage, then they go back and decide whether they have a movie or not. In animation,
it's so expensive to animate that you almost have to edit first. So then you only animate what is going to be in the movie, because it's just too expensive otherwise.
Logistically, this was partly made in Australia as well, in Sydney.
Yeah.
Did you guys spend any time there at all, or were you based in...
I went down for maybe 2-3 weeks. And we had these big, screens, like the CLI, I think that's what they're called. I don't know the technical name, but we talked with with Kelly, our unit director down there in Ostrand, like every day, like many times a day. So it's almost like when we would have meetings, they would be there, and we would say, okay, now can you change this? And we would act things out. Can you make them look a little more like this? And so it was really like we were there all the time. It was an amazing system. Yeah, and the Australia studio did such a great job with this film. It's unbelievable.
Talk about that watercolor animation. Yeah. What is that?
It's a technique that was used back in Snow White. It's really the original technique that Disney used, which is watercolor backgrounds, and then they put opaque characters over it. So when the hand-drawn cells, they're opaque, and it was a beautiful technique because everything seemed to pop. Everything really pops when you get that nice watery thing with a real solid character. That solid character really reads beautifully. And so this was a technique that hasn't been done in Disney for years, and they brought it back for the first Lilo and Stitch. So everyone had to relearn how to paint, because watercolor is a really hard medium to paint in.
You can't correct it, because if you go too far, you can't pull back. You have to start over again.
Yeah, so it's a really difficult medium. So Florida had to learn it. When they're the ones that animated the first Lilo and Stitch, and then Australia had to relearn everything and learn how to watercolor just for our film. And they did such a beautiful job. It's amazing. And an example of time is the first film, they would get maybe a week or two to paint a background. Australia get one day to paint, like, a background. And it's crazy.
Even their animation footage quotas, I mean, even the fastest animator that works at feature, you know, if they did 5 or 7 feet of animation, which I don't know how long is that, that's like a few seconds of animation, that would be the fastest that somebody probably could work footage a week. But in Australia, their basic requirement every week was 10. Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that it's excellent rather than just credible is pretty amazing. They're really dedicated, really hardworking, unbelievably well
done. You said this hadn't been done since Snow White. Why?
Well, actually, it started with Snow White.
Well, the watercolor backgrounds
have been
done
Peter Pan.
In the shorts before, but in the 30s it was...
In the 30s is when it kind of started.
Yeah.
They just got into acrylic painting, like Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid, with kind of that renaissance of Disney. It's also easier in acrylic, because you can paint over and make a mistake. If you make a mistake, you can paint over it. In watercolor, you have to throw it out and start over. So it really just became probably an issue of just easy.
And I think
how did they happen to revive it?
They wanted, Chris and Dean wanted a look that was, they went for a... For their film, they went for like a real retro look. They wanted it to feel like something that hasn't been done in a while, a real fresh look from Disney. At that point, I don't know if I should say this, but I mean, Disney was putting out movies that were feeling a little like we've seen them before. And so they wanted to do something really different. And they wanted it to be a Hawaiian retro. They worked in the whole kind of vintage feel.
And in a way, though, it was something that had been seen before, but just not in a really long time.
Right.
You know, just like any, you know, and I think it's also that probably one of the reasons that it was phased out over the years at the studio, not just my guess too, is that not only was it easier because of the opacity and the fact you can paint over it, but that the watercolor tends to remind you, you know, the texture of the thing that you're looking at a painting, and, you know, Walt's whole thing was to evolve more towards something where you really felt you were watching a real thing being played out. So there was something really refreshing about Dean and Chris just having this sort of like, you know, make a point of it, to go back to that really, especially where everything has that sort of you know, the Pixar films have that real sort of, or any computer animated image has a real sort of sheen to it. You know, it's a little, you know, even their warmest images, everything feels very solid and round, but it's a little bit like non-tactile in a way. But when you see that watercolor texture, there's something is it has more evocative of like an old storybook, you know, or an old like you know classic illustrated thing, and that's what those early Disney films had, you know, like Snow White and Pinocchio. So in a way, it harkened back to that. But I think because of the Hawaiian thing, it was a nice balance between something that was contemporary, so you're not thinking you're watching something dated either. That was the good thing about it.
And the sky, I mean, the Hawaiian skies, you guys have seen, if you got here yesterday, it's just...
It's no lie, yeah.
They're just so beautiful, and the watercolor really captures the color and the essence of that. They really caught the sky. They wanted us to try to see if we could do it in acrylic to match the look, and we really said, no, we have to do that watercolor. It's so integral.
For the direct video, they wanted to see if you would do it in acrylic?
Yeah, they wanted to see how we could do it in acrylic or computer, because they had to do it so fast, and they're like, how is Australia going to do one a day? There's no way. There's no way, but they stepped up to the plate.
How fast did you have to do it?
The whole film was 3 years. Believe it or not, it's quick for animation.
Yeah,
I know, it's crazy. I think it was only a year of animation. I think it was in Australia for a year.
Yeah.
We had a year of pre-production, a year, and then we'd take it back to our studio and can do color changes on the computer. The computer helped us a lot because watercolor is also a medium where you paint it in washes. So if you want a really dark sky, you have to let it dry and then paint another wash. Let it dry, paint another wash. And that takes days and days and days. So our art director, brilliant art director who came from Features with us, figured out how to do it on computer to darken the sky without taking the texture. So Australia ended up painting paintings that were much lighter than you see in the movie, and then we could richen them in computer. So it was really without taking away the watercolor. It's a real hard balance.
Yeah, and that probably, going back to the question before, that probably was one of the most anxiety-provoking, you know, processes to go through at the beginning, knowing that what we were up against in terms of the limitations and whether, and, you know, Marianne just did an amazing job. We were fortunate not only that she was, you know, a great artist in her own right and a watercolor painter, she's actually able to teach it, which is just, you know, we were so lucky.
She was a watercolor teacher, so we really liked it. So she went down to
Marianne Thomas.
Marianne Thomas.
Yeah.
Is it two words, Marianne?
It's one word.
Mary, A-N-N-E.
Okay.
And then Thomas. She went out to Australia and taught them how to paint watercolors and had big... And the clouds in Lilo are so unique, big puffy, there's like lots of different clouds, so she would have big boards, and here's how you paint the ABCs of this cloud, the ABCs of this cloud, the ABCs of this rock. It was crazy.
And another thing,
it was amazing.
Another thing about that, too, was that, you know, usually, again, because of the budgets and things for the smaller projects, there's usually not, like, trips involved for doing research, like in the first one, Chris and Dean came out, and that wasn't in the original game plan, but they actually... helped sort of push things along, let us say, so that Tony and I and Marianne were able to come out to Kauai and really get, because that was one of the things that Chris and Dean really felt strongly about as much as anything, about beyond even just the story and the characters, that there was a real sense of not just being some any Hawaiian generic USA type place, but specifically Kauai, like really that place. So going there was just, you know, it sounds great, hey, we went to Hawaii, but it really... was really important, and certainly for Marianne, you know, I think by actually coming here and not just relying on, you know, photographs or, you know, taking it on faith
when
that the colors
Kauai,
are that
did
way.
Did you actually photograph the clouds, ambiance, or did you paint it? You photographed.
She painted.
She
painted. We did a couple sketches, but...
No, it wasn't for us. It was
more, she cataloged. She has books and books of photographs of skies at different times of the day. And she's a real, I mean, people like that are amazing with color. They know the exact color that makes up the sunset or the sun every time of day. So if it's like 11, oh no, that would be a little more blue in that in Hawaii, or there would be a little more red. I mean, colors that would be hard to see, but they're...
Like the clock, like Tony said, she would know, like, oh yeah, it would be 11. Like, 11, it's okay, you know.
I mean, it was 11:30, right. Well, no, then the sun would be like, come on.
You're kidding.
Yeah, she was amazing. So she would just take pictures and pictures and of the rocks and it was very important for us to feel like it was Hawaiian, and we just didn't want it to. And I've been to Hawaii, but Michael's never been to Hawaii. We needed it to feel Hawaiian. And little things like something we say in here is like we had a squirrel in our movie that we want, and we went to Hawaii and realized that there are chickens everywhere. Chickens just run around everywhere. So we were like, okay, we can't have a squirrel. I don't even think there are squirrels in Hawaii. We have to have a chicken.
I think that's what came up. We were like,
yeah. Shoot, we got to change that to a chicken. Like little things like that, and I think the biggest impression of Hawaii was that rundown things are beautiful in Hawaii. Like, this view of Hawaii is not an enchanted fairy tale Hawaii. It's a real Hawaii. So we wanted to have a gas station. We love the idea of this rundown gas station that could be beautiful, because in Hawaii they are, for some reason. They're just like, they paint everything in these beautiful colors, and the foliage kind of creeps into everything, and the vines, and it just, everything looks beautiful. So we wanted to include that as well. We wanted it to really feel the,
yeah,
I don't know if that was your question.
What did you do on that trip that helped you decide what the plot was going to be?
Something about the myth, right?
Yeah, we discovered, thank God, the biggest thing was this great myth about Pele and Hiiaka. And is that Pele and Hiiaka were sisters, and Hiiaka's lover was Lohiau, but we don't obviously say lover. And we talked to the Hawaiian people about that. They say that when they tell kids the stories, they can just say they're friends. So Hiiaka had this friend named Lohiau, and Pele grew jealous and killed him and threw him into a volcano because she was jealous. And then Hiiaka, though, loved him so much that she stayed with his body and prayed to the gods that his spirit would come back. And he came back to life. And so this was just incredibly moving myth, and we wanted to really show Lilo was a child of the island. Something that Chris and Dean, when we talked to them, we said, "Is there anything that you wish you could have done that you didn't do in yours?" And they said, "Well, we wish that you would have showed Lilo was really a girl of the islands more, so that she respects the myths, she lives by those myths." So we knew that Stitch was going to have something wrong with him. So it was when we had that myth that we realized, okay, let's take it to the final degree and have... Did you guys know the movie? Do you know what it's...
Yeah.
You know what happened? Okay, so you know Stitch dies. Okay, so Stitch dies, and so that was the perfect myth to parallel what Lilo was going through, and it to be really about the unconditional love of her friend, and that it's the magic of the islands that brings him back to life.
So. Oh, no, you're
kidding. Stop the tape.
So it was that, yeah.
But how did you learn that? I mean, is this like, does everybody know this, or did you?
We had a guide. A guide named Francis.
Yeah, Francis. Oh,
so many years ago.
He actually took Chris and Dean around. That's why we got him, because he was the same. Sorry, I can't remember his last name. But he was the tour guide that took Chris and Dean around.
But he knows everything about every myth, every legend. He knows everyone on the islands, and everyone kind of knows everyone. It's so weird. Everyone knows everyone, and he would say, "Hey, mahalo, whatever, aloha." And little things like we would go up to. He wanted to show us exactly the leaf, how to make a lei, a proper lei. So we would go up into these mountains, and he would find the perfect bush, and then they would pick the leaves just right, how to make this certain kind of lei. And then when we came down, he was telling us that there was this legend. It started to rain, and he said, "Oh, someone up there must have picked the flowers, because there's this legend that if you pick this certain flower, it upsets Pele and it rains." And these people don't, it's not like they worship Pele, but it's part of their tradition still, the locals. And so they respect these stories as if they're true. It's not like they're worshiping Pele,
but it's weird, they respect this tradition. Yeah, it's not as if like there's a specific like religious thing, but because it was part of a culture, you know, just the whole thing with, you know, the whole history with the U.S. taking over Hawaii, how it's just an interesting balance that they have between, you know, they're proud to be American, but there's still this cultural, if not religious, yeah, it's hard to exactly, like, define what it is, but he really lived it and felt it, and that had a lot. I mean, there were a lot of ideas he gave us that you just couldn't put everything into the movie, but it definitely kept us more on that track than just sitting somewhere in Burbank going, "Well, what do you think they would do in Hawaii?" Or, "What do you think they think?" You know,
like he would take us to friends of his that played guitar outside their house, and he would say, "Oh, you got to come here, my friends. They play great guitar." And so they just would sit outside their house on these boxes, and they would just play guitars and things. And so then we said, "Oh, that's a great idea for the garage guys. Why don't we just have them in the garage sitting and playing guitar?"
Yeah, it's like the informality with which their traditions are expressed, I guess. You know, I suppose it, well, I mean, because my family, my mom's family's Italian, and, you know, I mean, in Italy, it's a little like that, but then there's opera. But there's not, like, any high culture in Hawaii. It's all, like, low-key, but it's still really expressive of these, you know, these great traditions and beliefs.
Yeah. So then another example, he took us to this keiki festival where the kids were dancing, and we actually went on May, and May Day's a big celebration. And so he said, oh, you got to come see the May Day celebration. So we would go and see the May Day celebration, and it was all these beautiful kids, and they all made up their costumes. And something we learned about hula is that they don't have to be about legends or anything fancy. Like, one of them was about, like, a car ride. Oh, in your car, you're going down there, and you're honking your horn, and whoo, honk, honk. I mean, they just do hula about anything, really. So that's when we realized, oh, then the kids can make up their own hulas, and they can make up their own kind of costumes. And so we put the May Day celebration in our movie, and so it's everything he really told us, we tried to incorporate some kind of truth into what we had. So that's
how free did you feel to work with the myth and legend aspect of it, given that, you know, Native Hawaiians in particular are very sensitive about how their culture is appropriated or synthesized into?
We had a lot of people tell us that it was like, we had a lot of checks and balances. We had, there's a man named Kuneva Mook who was the voice of the Kumu in the first movie, and he's the voice, and he taught the dancing, and he's the voice of the Kumu teacher in our movie, and he was kind of like our official, okay, what do you think about this? And he was right in Burbank, and he has kids, he choreographed all the dance in our movie, and his kids win for hula contests like all around the world. And so we said, okay, Kuneva, are we going to make anyone mad if we do this? Are we going to make anyone mad if we do this? And he said, no. And we talked to Dennis and David Kamakahi, who are big kind of famous singers on the islands, about, now, how do you tell the legend if it's not a lover? Because we couldn't really say lover. It's a Disney movie. And he said, no, you could just say when we tell the legend to kids, we say that they're friends instead of lovers. So it's really, the legend is, we got it right from the horse's mouth, kind of, so we made sure we didn't insult anyone. We really wanted to respect the Hawaiian culture, because this movie has to be respectful of that, or we're not doing our job right.
Could you spell that man's name?
Kamakahi? Oh, Kuneva Mook?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a...
is it in the first
name? Yeah, it's K-U-N-E-W-A, I believe, even though they pronounce it with a V. It's Kuneva. Yeah.
Okay.
Can you explain again about you said they painted the watercolors lighter and then you were able to darken it up in the computer? Is that something that was done just for the direct video? Or
no, they did it for both.
They probably did it for the first one. Except they had more, I know they did more layers, right?
They had more time, but there's always a little bit of tweaking, so to speak, that has to take place, you know, so to speak. So it's not completely devoid of the touch of the computer, but essentially you're looking at, you know, I don't know what percentage, 95% of what you're looking at is there because it was hand-painted, not, you know, but it was just a practical matter of, even for Marianne, knowing that, you know, you don't have time to waste a painting. You have to get it to a certain point where it's like, okay, if it goes one step too far, it'll be too dark, the painting will be ruined. Have them stop at this point, and then at the next, that extra little bit where you know you can monkey around with it and not waste the painting, you do that at the digital level.
So is it time-saving?
Oh, yeah, totally. That's all it is. And it wouldn't, you know...
Something that they told us on the first movie that really made us nervous was the art director said that he would go and visit the painters at 9 o'clock, and then he would go back at 10 o'clock and the paintings would be ruined. Like, because if you just go, like, a little off and you, like, the blue goes into the pink, that's it. Start over. So we're like, oh my God.
Because, you know, watercolor paper, it's not just like, okay, take another pad and put it down. It has to be prepared and stretched and, you know, wetted on a frame or a board. And so it's really time consuming just to even, before you can even put the brush on the paper. So, there was
so we really used
no
a lot of computer and Photoshop to help our movie look like as much. Exact color that makes up the sunset or the sun every time of day. So if it's like 11, oh no, that would be a little more blue in that in Hawaii, or there would be a little more red. I mean, colors that we consider hard to see, but they're...
Like the clock, like Tony said, she would know, like, oh yeah, it would be 11. Like, 11, it's okay, you know,
I mean,
it's 9, it's all right.
Well, no, then the sun would be like, come on.
You can't, you're kidding.
Yeah, she was amazing, so she would just take pictures and pictures and of the rocks and it was very important for us to feel like it was Hawaiian, and we just didn't want it to, and I've been to Hawaii, but Michael's never been to Hawaii. We needed it to feel Hawaiian. And little things, like something we say in here is, like, we had a squirrel in our movie that we want, and we went to Kauai and realized that there are chickens everywhere. Chickens just run around everywhere. So we were like, okay, we can't have a squirrel. I don't even think there are squirrels in Hawaii. We have to have a chicken.
I think that's what came up. We were like,
yeah. Shoot, we got to change that to a chicken. Like, little things like that, and I think the biggest impression of Hawaii was that rundown things are beautiful in Hawaii. Like, this view of Hawaii is not an enchanted fairy tale Hawaii. It's a real Hawaii. So we wanted to have a gas station. We love the idea of this rundown gas station that could be beautiful, because in Hawaii they are, for some reason. They're just like, they paint everything in these beautiful colors, and the foliage kind of creeps into everything, and the vines, and it just, everything looks beautiful. So we wanted to include that as well. We wanted it to really feel the,
yeah,
I don't know if that was your question.
What did you do on that trip that helped you decide what the plot was going to be?
Something about the myth, right?
Yeah, we discovered the biggest thing was this great myth about Pele and Hiiaka. And is that Pele and Hiiaka were sisters, and Hiiaka's lover was Lohiau, but we don't obviously say lover. And we talked to the Hawaiian people about that. They say that when they tell kids the stories, they can just say they're friends. So Hiiaka had this friend named Lohiau, and Pele grew jealous and killed him and threw him into a volcano because she was jealous. And then Hiiaka, though, loved him so much that she stayed with his body and prayed to the gods that his spirit would come back. And he came back to life. And so this was just incredibly moving myth, and we wanted to really show Lilo was a child of the island. Something that Chris and Dean, when we talked to them, we said, is there anything that you wish you could have done that you didn't do in yours? And they said, well, we wish that you would have showed Lilo was really a girl of the islands more, so that she respects the myths, she lives by those myths. So we knew that Stitch was going to have something wrong with him. So it was when we had that myth that we realized, okay, let's take it to the final degree and have... Did you guys know the movie? Do you know what it's...
Yeah.
You know what happened? Okay, so you know Stitch dies. Okay, so Stitch dies, and so that was the perfect myth to parallel what Lilo was going through, and it to be really about the unconditional love of her friend, and that it's the magic of the islands that brings him back to life.
So. Oh, no, you're
kidding. Stop the tape.
So it was that, yeah.
But how did you learn that? I mean, is this like, does everybody know this, or did you?
We had a guy named Francis.
Yeah, Francis
O'Gamore. So many years ago.
He actually took Chris and Dean around. That's why we got him, because he was the same. Sorry, I can't remember his last name, but he was the tour guide that took Chris and Dean around.
But he knows everything about every myth, every legend. He knows everyone on the islands, and everyone kind of knows everyone. It's so weird. Everyone knows everyone, and he would say, hey, ma, whatever, aloha. And and little things like we would go up to, he wanted to show us exactly how to make a lei, a proper lei. So we would go up into these mountains, and he would find the perfect bush, and then they would pick the leaves just right, how to make this certain kind of lei. And then when we came down, he was telling us that there was this legend. It started to rain, and he said, oh, someone up there must have picked the flowers, because there's this legend that if you pick this certain flower, it upsets Pele and it rains. And these people don't, it's not like they worship Pele, but it's part of their tradition still, the locals. And so they respect these stories as if they're true. It's not like they're worshiping Pele,
but it's weird, they respect this tradition. Yeah, it's not as if like there's a specific like religious thing, but because it was part of a culture, you know, just the whole thing with, you know, the whole history with the U.S. taking over Hawaii, how it's just an interesting balance that they have between, you know, they're proud to be American, but there's still this cultural, if not religious, yeah, it's hard to exactly, like, define what it is, but he really lived it and felt it, and that had a lot. I mean, there were a lot of ideas he gave us that you just couldn't put everything into the movie, but it definitely kept us more on that track than just sitting somewhere in Burbank going, well, what do you think they would do in Hawaii, or what do you think they think, you know?
Like, he would take us to friends of his that played guitar outside their house, and he would say, oh, you got to come hear my friends, they play great guitar. And so they just would sit outside their house on these boxes, and they would just play guitars and things. And so then we said, oh, that's a great idea for the garage guys. Why don't we just have them in the garage sitting and playing guitar?
Yeah, it's like the informality with which their traditions are expressed, I guess. You know, I suppose, because my family, my mom's family's Italian, and you know, I mean, in Italy it's a little like that, but then there's opera. But there's not like any high culture in Hawaii. It's all like low key, but it's still really expressive of these, you know, these great traditions and beliefs.
But then we, another example, he took us to this keiki festival where the kids were dancing, and we actually went on May, and May Day is a big celebration. And so he said, oh, you got to come see the May Day celebration. So we would go and see the May Day celebration, and it was all these beautiful kids, and these, they all made up their costumes. And something we learned about hula is that they don't have to be about legends or anything fancy. Like, one of them was about, like, a car ride. Oh, in your car, you're going down, then you're honking your horn, and whoo, honk, honk. I mean, they just do hula about anything, really. So that's when we realized, oh, then the kids can make up their own hulas, and they can make up their own kind of costumes. And so we put the May Day celebration in our movie, and we, so it's everything he really told us, we tried to incorporate some kind of truth into what we had. So that's
how free did you feel to work with the myth and legend aspect of it, given that, you know, Native Hawaiians in particular are very sensitive about how their culture is appropriated or synthesized into the
We had a lot of people tell us that it was like we had a lot of checks and balances. We had there's a man named Kuneva Mook who was the voice of the Kumu in the first movie, and he's the voice, and he taught the dancing, and he's the voice of the Kumu teacher in our movie, and he was kind of like our official, okay, what do you think about this? And he was right in Burbank, and he has kids, he choreographed all the dance in our movie, and his kids win for hula contests like all around the world. And so we said, okay, Kuneva, are we going to make anyone mad if we do this? Are we going to make anyone mad if we do this? And he said, no, and we talked to Dennis and David Kamakahi, who are big kind of famous singers on the islands, about, now, how do you tell the legend if it's not a lover? Because we couldn't really say lover, it's a Disney movie. And he said, no, you could just say, when we tell the legend to kids, we say that they're friends instead of lovers. So it's really, the legend is, we got it right from the horse's mouth, kind of, so we made sure we didn't insult anyone. We really wanted to respect the Hawaiian culture, because this movie has to be respectful of that, or we're not doing our job right.
Could you spell that man's name?
Kamakahi. Oh, Kuneva Mook?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a...
is it in the
book? Yeah, it's K-U-N-E-W-A, I believe, even though they pronounce it with a V. It's Kuneva. Yeah.
Okay.
Can you explain again about the... You said they painted the watercolors lighter, and then you were able to darken it up in the computer? Is that something that was done just for the direct video? Or
no, they did it for both.
They probably did it for the first one. Except they had more... I know they did more layers, right?
They had more time, but there's always a little bit of tweaking, so to speak, that has to take place, you know, so to speak. So it's not completely devoid of the touch of the computer, but essentially you're looking at, you know, what, I don't know what percentage, 95% of what you're looking at is there because it was hand-painted, not, you know, but it was just a practical matter of, even for Marianne, knowing that, you know, you don't have time to waste a painting. You have to get it to a certain point where it's like, okay, if it goes one step too far, it'll be too dark, the painting will be ruined. Have them stop at this point, and then at the next, that just that extra little bit where you know you can monkey around with it and not waste the painting, you do that at the digital level.
So is it time saving?
Oh, yeah, totally. That's all it is. And it wouldn't, you know...
Something that they told us in the first movie that really made us nervous was the art director said that he would go and visit the painters at 9 o'clock, and then he would go back at 10 o'clock and the paintings would be ruined. Like, because if you just go like a little off and you like the blue goes into the pink, that's it. You start over. So we're like, oh my god.
Because you know, watercolor paper, it's not just like, okay, take another pad and put it down. It has to be prepared and stretched and you know wetted on a frame or a board. And so it's really time-consuming, just to even before you can even put the brush on the paper. So there was
so we really used
no
a lot of computer and Photoshop to help our movie look like this.
You've been listening to DVD Talk Radio. Find DVD Talk Radio online at dvdtalkradio.com.